Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to After Things. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hello!
Bryce Castillo.
Hello!
Brian Brushwood.
Hi.
Let's jump right into a question. This is really a good one. Hey there, weird boys. We'll take it. I'd love to hear all of your takes on pen names. I've decided to come up with a pen name for the first book I'm working on because I share an identical name, including middle name, with a famous person. This is by George Washington, by the way. I've been looking into everything I can online about how to go about doing this, but it's really unclear as to whether I have to use my legal name or my pen name on the copyright notice in the book. Sources differ on this. Would it defeat the purpose if I had to print my legal name in the copyright section, the name on the copyright paperwork that holds the copyright, regardless of the fact that the copyright paperwork states the pseudonym? Anyone know of a way around this? I've read about people filing copyright strictly under the pseudonym and not identifying the legal names on the paperwork, but this causes problems in the future if there's an issue of proving that you're the legal copyright holder. I've heard of people using coded number languages to embed a secret message in the book, a strand of numbers that basically translates, so I'm so-and-so and I'm the legal copyright holder for this book in case they ever need to prove it. That seems crazy. There's got to be a better way. I don't want my legal name available to the public through the copyright office, the copyright info of the book, scratching my head over this. Thoughts, experiences, Selena. Not really named George Washington. I lied about that. I'm sorry. As far as that goes, like, yeah, the copyright office says you can use a pseudonym. You can use another name. And, of course, the problem is if somebody else comes up and says, hey, I'm that person, you then have to establish that, like, no, I am. And you still, if you ever try to take a copyright to court, you still have to prove priority to it. A filed copyright, it can establish that you filed it first, but it's not ironclad either. So what I've done is I have an LLC and it's my same name. It's Andrew Main, and I've done Doing Business As, so I've established that. Also, when you create a work, let's say if you write a book and you publish it, the medium in which it's published can help establish that. So if you make it available on Amazon's Kindle and that data first availability or whatever can help establish that. I found that, like, I don't know of anybody really getting it, having difficulty establishing priority on this. I think that it's often, as you know, first time authors, we worry a lot about establishing copyright, and it's really never the problem that we think it's going to be. Certainly file the Library of Congress. If you file and it's your address and you're the one to file it there, then you have a pretty good establishment of, like, yes, I'm the person, you know, Selena Smith, who filed for this because that's my address, this is my return, whatever, and that's my pseudonym, et cetera, without having to put your real name.
So. Yeah, I think a lot of the preemptive thought and action that goes into these things are basically a boil down, like, well, what if it's good and what if somebody wants to steal it from me? Those are great things to consider, but understand that if it's good and somebody wants to steal it from you, then you are the one in a position of authority, unless you've been secretly working with a collaborator who could make a legitimate claim to own more of it than you do. So if that's the case, all you need to have is what you personally, and maybe your attorney if you feel like getting expert advice, perceives to be a preponderance of evidence that this is your work. So that could be everything from turning on a GoPro and be like, hi, I'm typing my book. It's going to be called this. I'm going to write it under the name so-and-so. Here it is. I'm going to put this in a safe place. And here I am, video footage of me putting a manuscript, mailing it to myself to a secure address in an unopened envelope and all that stuff. The point is, none of this matters unless somebody claims that they're the ones who created the work and not you, in which case, just create as much evidence as it takes to make you feel comfortable that there will be no question about it.
So realistically, if you are writing a book and you are posting it in the place where people buy and read books, which would be Amazon, the Kindle ecosystem, you are creating an account for your pseudonym that pays out to you. You still control that account. Would that not be sufficient proof to prove that you're the person that uploaded the book, that it's yours?
Well, when you get the sufficient proof is going to be up to a judge or a jury to decide. Would it seem reasonable and more than, you know, like likely? Yeah. And I'm not aware of copyright cases have gone very far where, you know, the minimal threshold of, you know, copyright has been, you know, I'm not aware of anybody taking it past the point of like, yeah, no, here's my Word document. This is dated here. I put this on the Kindle store here. I sent this to Library of Congress where it gets fought beyond that. I'm not aware of that. I mean, and frankly, it's like, I don't know what, you know, works have ever really, you know, get that contested.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think what we're saying first and foremost is do not let questions like this get in the way of creativity, right? Like make sure that you are focusing on the production of what you want to do. The pen name stuff will, you know, is at least in all likelihood very academic. Like, yeah, you will be able to prove that you are this person, because especially now, just to publish it, you're just creating a lot of data trails that are like just there. You're in control of it. You can show, hey, look, this is the email that I got to my email address on when I submitted it to the store on the date that it was publicly listed. So
in the case of like Google Docs, you could go back, like, these are the time codes and all of the modifications and all of the edits I made going back over the 6 months that it took me to create this thing. Here's the account. That's fairly compelling evidence.
Not to mention, you know, if you're doing this on, you know, self-published on Amazon, the fact that you have this tied to your own bank accounts, tied to any other, like, there are a lot of concrete ways that you have to have stuff go to your person, maybe not necessarily your real name, that if that feels like it would be a pretty clear sign that you are the person, yeah, who is the right owner.
It's things do get stolen, but it's exceptionally rare. And in, let's say something does happen. Let's say, you know, you've written the next great, you know, robot love romance book. One, if you put it up on Amazon first, you're first there, it's hard for someone to copy it because you know, Amazon has copyright protection measures. Let's say you write it, but you haven't submitted it anywhere, but you've let people read it, and somebody takes it from you, or you were giving it out to people to read, and somebody wants to take it, put their name on it, and go publish it. You know, if it's a clear case like that, you still have to hire an attorney. You still have to go through things to do this, which are expensive, you know, and there is that threshold. And I've not heard of any cases of that happening where somebody's just outright tried to steal somebody's work like that. I'm sure it has. But in any case, you know, copyright, establishing that is one step, but then it's still, copyrights cost money to defend. They're easy to get. You get them when you create something. You just magically have one just by the act of creation. But defending copyrights are going to be expensive no matter what.
Right. And you know, it sounds like what the writer is more concerned about is having her real name out there, or yeah, tied, and possibly any, you know, if someone else has that name, any undue attention that might come from having that name being tied to stuff. And I think, you know, that protection with a pen name is certainly going to be worth more than whatever hassle would be if someone decided to steal this work under the assumption that it's a pen name. Like mm-hmm. The cons definitely are outweighed by the pros.
Yeah. Yeah. So file your copyright, use your pen name on there. There's the way. If you don't want to put your real name there, don't do it. And then, you know, I wouldn't stress out, you know, again, things could happen, but it's more of a first time author thing. We worry about that. Cause we've invested all this time and energy in it. And our fear is that somebody's going to try to take this from us.
Yeah. I think I saw a Reddit headline saying that Joe Hill, Stephen King's son, managed to publish for 10 years before anybody found out that he was Stephen King's son. So it may be a situation where it's important to this author that they be established under their own name. So I don't know. It could certainly be done.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, once somebody knows who you are, you know, that'll be out there though. You know, the internet, you know.
Yeah. That internet.
Yeah.
Is mucking things up.
Yep. So this was a story I had for weird things, but I think it's kind of could be kind of a after things too thing too. Just, you know, playing around with like I got the Oculus Quest, which we talked about in the other show, and I love it. And I started thinking like, man, it'd be cool to like, it has a built-in microphone, right? And I'm like, man, How would we record a podcast inside of virtual reality?
How would we record a podcast? Well, I guess the question would be, what are we creating? A, is it our way of doing the visual? Like, are we, like, in essence, recording our video component by way of VR?
Well, we could do scenarios, you know, imagine being able to do stuff where we talk about things, and as we talk about them, they happen, kind of animated sort of stuff. You know, if we're talking about goblins are there or what have you. And this is VR chat.
So this is a viral series of videos from Searmore on YouTube, where he goes and talks to people in VR chat. And I guess maybe because of having, you know, an avatar, you get people to really open up. This is a kid in VR chat talks about being bullied. And he's got they've got multiple of these sorts of types of videos. But this, you know, with the hand controllers and the little avatars, it seems like, I mean, these videos have gotten a lot of attention over the past few months.
There's also, I believe there was a news story last week, maybe it was a Reddit thread, but somebody had done some homegrown full body interpolation stuff where basically he combined it with the Vive Knuckles controllers to give a fairly believable full-bodied avatar just with off-the-shelf Vive and Knuckles equipment.
Well, there's a new development too, which is machine learning to animate photos. And Facebook, I think we showed before, was doing a really good job of creating avatars. So we're getting to the point where just using maybe some past video of somebody and voice, you're able to create a pretty realistic 3D avatar in there. And of course, I think the fun part is to do it, make it more cartoony or something. But it would be so much fun to do, I think, you know, almost like a cartoon-like thing. Now, here we're watching a video of they take just a few photos of a person, and they're able to map this person and have this person talking. And it's pretty incredible. They've shown examples. It's using one photo, and it's incredibly realistic. And they take the Mona Lisa, and they animate the Mona Lisa, and she speaks and talks. And this isn't like the real talk thing where they just try to morph the face onto a 3D model. This is a computer that's looking at the face and trying to understand what are eyes, what are mouth, and how should this behave.
Yeah, this is a Samsung that I think did this technology, right?
I think that one is.
I mean, we got to be, what, 5-10 years from being able to strap on a full resolution headset and feel like we're seeing literally any person we want saying literally anything they want?
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing about some of this, like, I think a big first step is going to be animation, is that we saw the system that was able to, like, fake Flintstones animation sequences or photos. And I think we're going to get soon. I think, you know, you're going to get, you know, your ability to interpolate frames is fantastic. So I think we're going to start seeing a lot more animated content now done this way.
And I could see them marketing it as something innocuous, like a virtual makeup or something, where it's like, hey, a lot of these actors, it takes hours for them to be in makeup. Now they could just show right up on the job and just get cleaned up digitally. Wow.
We're looking at the Mona Lisa talk right now. And
she's a bit sassier than I had expected.
Yeah right?
There's something about seeing her at a even just a slightly different angle that feels very surreal, because it's such a you know, world-renowned image.
Well, yeah, it just makes you, like, the Mona Lisa kind of seems iconic. It's unnatural in that it's so iconic, right?
Yeah.
And then you see it move, and you're like, oh, wait, that's just like a lady.
Yeah, right? That's not the lady frozen in time for half a millennia. That's just a lady.
I've seen ladies talk my whole life. This is crazy.
That's she probably has a favorite cannoli. That's not the same cannoli I like. I don't know.
Yeah, anyway, let me get back to my cannoli vlog.
So J.C. Calhoun points out there's somebody who does a podcast inside of, like, a video game. And, you know, and we get form of that, like, with Twitch and, you know, game live streaming. We're getting there. And I'm just sort of thinking about the idea of almost software or something that's sort of dedicated to that end.
Yeah. I mean, I think VR chat has been its own very interesting platform to watch, because I think that is the seeds of where we would be going with a more production focused version of communicating with each other in a virtual world, because it's I mean, the possibilities are really exciting.
So yeah. To bring it back to an After Things topic, do we feel like this is an emerging market that we feel like somebody should be first to establish dominance in? Because may I remind you, there was a time that BB Live Show was among the top shows on Ustream, which ultimately got supplanted by other markets or whatever. But that's for anybody trying to make it. That's a smart play is to be early.
But you know, it's like, who remembers Rocket Boom?
Sure,
I do.
What is Rocket Boom?
It was a news thing. It was like a daily YouTube show that people would make fun of.
But that was before YouTube.
I guess it was around. I saw it on YouTube on around 2005.
Yeah, it started in 2004, and I guess that was the thing. It's like they were kind of ahead of the curve, but the cost and all that to do it, and then a couple years later, YouTube comes out, and all of a sudden, it's like, boom, you know, a flood. You know,
well, because you know, there was that time when YouTube came around that everybody—well, not everybody, but people that were like, "Oh, we're going to create our own video content. This is a competing platform. We certainly cannot help it succeed. We need to drive people to our site."
I wouldn't know of a single company I worked for that had that opinion.
Yeah, yeah. I remember when.
Yeah, I think certainly investing a lot of time in a platform you believe in is worthwhile. You know, of course, maybe not, you know, some of the other fly by night ones we've seen before.
Yes.
You know, the 8-second video ones and things like that, you know.
Actually, I think Vine was really on a trajectory to crush it. And for the life of me, I can't understand why, two, 3 years after Twitter crushed Vine, my 11-year-old still is quoting Vines that she's seeing on YouTube because they've been archived and collected on that platform. I think Vine was on, and now we're seeing TikTok, which was a lip syncing app for kids.
Physically.
And then and then now they're like, well, we can be Vine. That's fine.
I mean, I don't know. I do think that there's probably a really good long form article about kind of the death of Vine and you know, where that kind of went. But that being said, if we're going to put that in the catalog of strong decision making from the clear focus of Twitter leadership, then it kind of makes more sense.
Well, I wonder, like, with difference between TikTok and Vine was it was like 6 seconds just wasn't enough. That was like there was something about the idea of short, but that 6 seconds felt like it was just too short. You know.
Well, you saw this with Instagram, but also TikTok is both of those services have built upon the short form format that Vine did, but also added, you know, on TikTok, you can do 15-second or 1-minute videos, right? Instagram, you can do very long videos or IGTV, live streaming. TikTok has live streaming stories. Like it's building upon that feature set and not just being, you know, in the same way that Twitter for so long was stuck in 140 and even now feels stuck in 280. All the other services blossomed because they broke out of those constraints.
Yeah, Instagram Stories is a better version of Snapchat. Snapchat was not able to evolve and add the features that Instagram Stories were. They were too stuck in this idea that they were special because of their idiosyncrasies. Except Vine, Twitter didn't see a future in. So they shuttered it and musically realized that, okay, well, we can add these things that we can break through these pain points and make this a bigger platform. To me, I look at Snapchat and Vine as products that are similar to Facebook before they realized that the news feed was the future. When everything was siloed and page-centric, then they had a popular service. They added the networking, and now they had something that was sustainable that would be a forever generator of content. And both of those, both Snapchat and Vine, I look at as like they were never really able to find their newsfeed. They were never able to find that thing that made it bigger and better and continued to evolve.
I was excited about Vine when it first launched, but as I was thinking like, oh, if they put this thing up to a minute, I could see useful minute-like content. You know, I could think that you could do a movie review, a book review. You could do a lot of stuff inside of a minute. That would seem to be like, for my arbitrary number, I thought would have been a cool length to have chosen. But
Yeah, and that's what Instagram landed on a minute. Like, yeah. And then post minute they have, or more than a minute they have IGTV, which is God knows how that even works.
Yeah. Want to jump into picks?
Yeah, I got a pick. So, we watched in Italy only very few things that were new in America. We watched Game of Thrones, got a VPN so we could watch Game of Thrones. But then we watched something that was being buzzed about very heavily, and I'm so thrilled that we watched it. It is the unauthorized Bash Brothers story by The Lonely Island. It is exceptional. 30 minutes and not a moment wasted. Just out of nowhere, The Lonely Island dropped a new album, all concepted based on the 1980s or 90s tandem of Jose Canseco and Mark McGwire, the sluggers for the Oakland Athletics. If you have no idea about baseball, it's you're not going to miss much. It's bizarre and ridiculous. But if you the one primer, if you know nothing of these guys going into it, is that they both were using anabolic steroids, and eventually it became a gigantic scandal. Man, I have no clue, no earthly idea how they were able to get the blessing of Major League Baseball to use the logos and footage that they use, because it's not a flattering portrait of these two real life people. And granted, it's cartoonish and it's ridiculous and it's heightened to an unrealistic degree, but the famously prudish Major League Baseball allowing them to use copyrighted names and stuff is just amazing.
I mean, one, remember when I talked about the Jeff Bezos announcement being something like, we're in a post singularity age and that was made for me?
Yeah.
I watched this and I'm like, they made this for Justin.
Yeah.
So good. It's so good.
I'm like,
down to the drone footage of like my neighborhood. Oh God. It's so, so, so funny. And the raps, man, they're really good at raps. The Lonely Island. Well done.
Yeah. Did they have to get permission from LB? Because it's clearly parody.
They thank them. I went and looked. I tried to look up anything I could on it afterwards. So they thank MLB and ESPN and NBC for the footage of the games that they show, the real life footage of the games mm-hmm. they show. And they certainly are, you know, using copyrighted, you know, names. I mean, I guess it's less of a would it fall under parody and more of a does it, you know, get picked up the way that it does if they don't have the blessing. But however it is, man, they certainly don't pull any punches because they're using the Athletics logo, because there's a lot of just like out and out conversations about anabolic steroids and roid rage. And considering how bizarre of a person Jose Canseco is, it was not surprising to me that he tweeted out how much he enjoyed it. I don't think that Mark McGwire has an official comment on it yet, but if you have liked any of the Lonely Island stuff on SNL or anything else, it's well worth a watch. It's only 30 minutes and it's amazing.
Yeah.
Hells yeah.
I only follow that whole thing peripherally, and I enjoyed it thoroughly.
It's just one of those things where they've never done anything with like real people before on that level, or at least that I could think of, or that weren't like friends of theirs where they're making fun of famous people or something like that. But these are like, it's a fairly niche thing, and they're like ridiculous, like in terms of describing the side effects of steroids and just talking openly about how many steroids there are.
Yeah.
So I got a pick. It's Anything by Andrew Heaton. You guys have probably heard either Justin or I show up on Something's Off with Andrew Heaton. Guess what? They just dropped a new video over at Reason.com, and it is a surprisingly even-handed parody of the current field. I think that whether you're on the right side or the left side, you'll find it very, very funny. The 2020 presidential candidate blowout sketch. They're just funny. He's funny, and his partner's funny, and just go watch everything Andrew Heaton ever does.
Yeah, I'll be on his show tomorrow talking about my theory that Kim Kardashian's going to run for president.
Yeah.
Cool. I got a pick. I finished this while we were doing banked episodes. I was kind of stuck on the last two episodes, and I finished it since then, and I'm very glad that I did because I was worried it would get like a binge fade, right? But it is Hulu's The Act. I finished The Act. This is the story about Gypsy. Oh my goodness, I don't remember the last name. About the young girl who whose mother is doing Munchausen by proxy by doing these frauds and telling the daughter that she's sick. She's telling her she's the wrong age, that she's, you know, only 16 when she's actually 20. And it's a real life dramatization of the real life murder that she and a boy that she meets online commit against the mother. It is fantastic. And I think the final episodes do a very good job of putting into context, like the first five or six episodes, it's very strong of like what the mother is doing is awful and unconscionable. And you see, you know, them putting a feeding tube in, you see her, you know, you got to shave your head because you've got cancer, but she's not taking, you know, radiology, you know, drugging her, lying to neighbors, lying to the government, and lying to doctors.
So it's a comedy romp.
It is incredibly difficult to watch if you're not ready for it. But on the flip side, the final two or three episodes, lay out and really remind you, hey, murder is wrong, everybody. What you did and what you and that boy did is not maybe the best way to have done it. It's very good, and it's nice and short. It's like eight episodes or something. And Patricia Arquette is great as the mother. It's a fantastic series. It's on Hulu. It's The Act.
I have one, I think, a follow-up I mentioned before, I think, was Chernobyl. If you haven't been watching that, check Chernobyl.
To be honest, I've been hesitant to give it a try because I know that there was so many of the numbers were blown out of proportion at the time of Chernobyl that I was afraid that it was going to be a blown out of proportion thing. Like if you say to watch it, I'll watch it because I think, you know, what I don't want to do is sit there arms crossed saying that's not how it went.
I don't know how it went. I read a lot of accounts of what happened. And I know that, you know, we had on one side, you had the Soviets eager to downplay. The other side, you had anti-nuclear groups eager to exaggerate and say it was way worse or whatever. And I don't know where the truth is on that. And I'm not quite sure anybody really knows. And it's frustrating because, you know, I was just reading, you know, I got an article about something else where they talked about a death count for some event that happened in the United States. And it was like, no, that's the most extreme death count. Nobody think it happened that much. But they just flat out stated that number because it made for a more sensational headline. Chernobyl is a very good example, I think, of the problems of the Soviet society of that. You know, we don't want to self-criticize. If we have problems, our goal is to you see a very clear example of, hey, we have a problem. Well, we can't have a big problem because it'll be problematic for us. So we'll just say it's smaller than it is. Hey, it's much bigger than it is. No, we can't say that it's bigger than it is. And you just see part of the reason why the Soviet, you know, empire collapsed was just the lying to itself, which not to say that, you know, and that's a problem with any culture. If we have that with our own problem, if we don't want to face our own problems, you know, we face the consequence of that. There's a country, not in the name of any, that's facing a very big anniversary soon, a 30-year anniversary, and nobody inside there knows what that anniversary is because they pretty much shut down the internet whenever it happens. And so I think it's a very good example of, you know, what happens with lack of transparency. So, and the detail on it's really, really good. So, but if you want something different, do you like vampires?
Oh my gosh, are you about to say what I think you're about to say?
Not even remotely. Never in a million years are you going to guess what I'm about to say.
I swear to God, I want to remain friends, so I'm hoping you're about to recommend the TV version of What We Do in the Shadows.
No, not. I haven't seen it yet. I'm sure if I saw it, I'd say this. No, I was going to recommend an audiobook called Necroscope, Brian. I'm sorry, our friendship's over. You decided this.
Seems like wow. A very weird bar to
really,
set, Brian.
Yeah, you really pushed all your chips in on the wrong hand there, Brian.
Now you're hog on
Brian sinks out of frame.
Is this the podcast? I think the podcast is done.
Yeah. So Necroscope is by Brian Lumley. It's a series of books. I think like six or seven of them on Audible. And Brian, you might like this if you're looking for like really cool horror sci-fi stuff. And it's a bit drawn out, but really detailed. It takes place in the 1980s, and it's a guy who can talk to the dead. And one of the things he's trying to do is stop this Soviet vampire. You know, just right. Bear with me, folks. It really, it's enjoyable. So, and What We Do in Shadows, the TV show, it's amazing.
It sure is. Down
tone. I want to watch it.
It's pretty great. I will vouch for the TV show. I think you guys are gonna love it.
I believe I loved the movie. So,
yeah,
cool. It's been after.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.